Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 27th day of February, 2021. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And how do we begin the wrap-up of another week where it's just become more and more obvious how far communist America has now fallen? I know. Maybe with a bit of irony that reveals the truth in spite of the whoppers. From the UK's version of the WAPO, the Daily Mail, which says in their headline, "No more ultra cold." The FDA has approved Pfizer's request to allow the coronavirus vaccine to be shipped and stored at regular freezer temperatures instead of colder than 76 below zero Fahrenheit. They call it a move to ease the rollout, and the point, of course, is that makes it easier to get it into more people's arms. And it makes perfect sense if you think about it, folks, because really, if it goes bad, who cares? Pfizer certainly isn't liable. The FDA's not about to take the blame. They're all immune from any harm they may cause. And if it doesn't work, well, who's going to know? They've proven they can cover up anything from side effects and outright deaths to simply not being effective. And besides, if you're willing to take the first poke, they know darn well you're going to line up and take more of them anyway, so ultimately it really doesn't matter. From there, let's talk about some very much related evil being revealed perhaps even more blatantly, in spite of the fact that it comes from a man whose record of prevarication should be, at least, legendary. And I'm referring to America's Dr. Mengele, Tony Fauci, who's arguably not just experimenting with twins and killing a few people in a lab, he's trying to kill a whole lot more publicly. And he's been working hard for a long time to destroy an entire society. His lies and self-contradictions have been well documented for a long time. I still wonder why anybody with half a brain listens to this guy. Mask on, mask off. You don't need a mask. They need a mask. No, you got to wear a mask. No, you got to wear two, maybe three. Who knows how many masks? Oh, yeah, and let's not forget, we're going to make you take the poke, even though we're going to also tell you it's not going to make a darn bit of difference. Listen to this.
There are certain aspects of being vaccinated and what that means to you personally and your own personal safety and that of your family versus what vaccines will allow you to do in society. One relates to you yourself being vaccinated.
And like, you know, whether it kills you outright or just preps you for whatever we've got planned next.
And the other relates to the number of people and the relative percentage of people in society that will be vaccinated.
And that, of course, is the real key. It's about the masses and mass control. But wait, then follows the admission. You have to listen through a bunch of Fauchistic BS to get there, but here we go.
So there are things, even if you're vaccinated, that you're not going to be able to do in society.
Say what? Haven't you been telling the dumbed-down masses the only way they'll ever get back to what they thought of as normal was to take the poke and be a guinea pig? But now you admit you were lying again?
So there are things, even if you're vaccinated, that you're not going to be able to do in society. For example, indoor dining, theaters, places where people congregate. That's because of the safety of society.
And don't kid yourself. That means their safety and the safety of their totalitarian control plans. And listen to this. He comes right out again and admits it.
You yourself, what you can do when you are together with another person, we are looking at that.
Yeah, we're looking at that, and we, your masters, will let you know what we will allow you to do, and of course, more importantly, what we won't.
You yourself, what you can do when you are together with another person, we are looking at that, and we're going to try and find out very quickly what recommendations could be made about what people can do.
Folks, if this kind of totalitarian condescension doesn't absolutely infuriate you, you've obviously been wearing one of those damn masks for too long, or maybe three or four of them. But this guy isn't done yet. He doesn't even try to hide it.
One of the things that's universal here that we know that at this point in time, it is unclear whether when you get vaccinated and you might be protected from clinical disease, which is the primary endpoint of the vaccine studies, that you could conceivably be infected, have virus in your nasopharynx, and at that same time have no symptoms.
Not like we haven't heard this before, but what he says is, hey, you could take the vaccine. It may not make a damn bit of difference. You might have something up your nose. You might not even know because you might not have any symptoms. So it's not hurting anybody, in other words. But wait, we're still going to exercise our totalitarian control over every aspect of your life. You peon slave, you. All of this, folks, is so damnably incriminating. If we still had laws against things like murder and treason, and, of course, an honest court system, and now we've seen again that that's long gone, this guy would have been on trial months ago, along with New York's greatest mass murderer, too, Andrew Cuomo. I'm going to play that whole admission again. Listen carefully.
One of the things that's universal here, that we know, that at this point in time, it is unclear whether when you get vaccinated and you might be protected from clinical disease, which is the primary endpoint of the vaccine studies,
pitifully rushed and incomplete as they were,
that you could conceivably be infected, have virus in your nasopharynx, and at that same time have no symptoms, which is the reason why we recommend and say you still need to wear a mask.
Because you know darn well, once we got that level of control, we never intend to let it go. You slave, you.
And for that reason, we want to make sure that people continue to wear masks despite the fact that they're vaccinated.
Any questions? Well, maybe there were, because by Friday, the guy was backpedaling again. What else is new? And he was trying to say, oh, well, we really do want vaccinated people. Not you anti-vaxxers, of course, but we want vaccinated people to be allowed to socialize. And we'll pick up that story with a bit more from the Daily Mail. Anthony Fauci's now revealed that there have been, quote, very serious discussions between the White House and the Central Disease Commission, or the CDC, about allowing people, isn't that nice of them, who have received their full course of COVID-1984 genetic modifications to socialize with other obedient little slaves. Isn't Master nice to us? But wait, it gets even more ridiculous. Fauci was even brazen enough to say that common sense showed the risk of vaccinated people being allowed by their master to socialize together was, quote, extremely low. But wait just a blankety-blanking minute. So was the risk of going out into public without your mandated face muzzle. One thing's for sure, though. If common sense says the risk is extremely low, it would also say that the risk of being a guinea pig and taking a DNA-modifying gene therapy injection that has absolutely no long-term testing whatsoever is anything but extremely low. So I started with that because one of the other top contenders for irony of the week was this one, which I'll introduce by noting,
come on, man.
Does anybody else out there have concerns about one of the most senile criminal mob bosses in U.S. history who now has his finger on the nuclear button? Turns out, if so, you're not alone. There are a whole bunch of Democrat co-conspirators who maybe aren't sleeping so well with that thought, even though they're lying to you while the press continues to cover it up, who are now calling on Biden to give up control of the nuclear football because they don't trust him either. Not that they're going to admit what everybody knows. The man is senile and can't be trusted to go to the bathroom on his own, much less sign things or do Communist China's bidding and start a nuclear war with Russia. All right, well, as you can see, all of these little trivialities do tend to rile your host up a bit, so I'm going to pause, take a deep breath, and tell an old joke that I think somehow fits really well here and kind of ends up where I want to go anyway. The joke is, however, a bit politically incorrect. I heard it decades ago, back before it became a capital crime, to tell a joke that might involve an ethnic stereotype. Well, with one obvious exception, of course, it's perfectly okay if the butt of the joke are the very people being slated to go first into the concentration camps, like old white guys. So with your permission, I'll rework this old joke just a bit. I was going to say, insert your favorite ethnicity here, but now let's do it this way. Let's talk about a group of people associated with, say, organized crime. We'll make up a name. Let's call them the Biden family. And let's call the head honcho of that group the big guy. I don't know, Creepy Joe. So with all that set up, let's go ahead and get to the joke. Creepy Joe and a couple of his buddies go out in their pickup truck to a local bar, and they get absolutely stinking wasted. Why, just to show you what I mean, Creepy Joe is so drunk, he lets a 12-year-old girl walk by without sniffing her hair. So when they decide to go home, they throw old Joe first to the back of the pickup truck. But one of them, a bit smarter than the other, says, hey, wait a minute, man, we can't do that. He'll fall out of the back of the truck and get killed. Oh, comes the response, we better let him drive. Yeah, bada bing. But do you see the point? they're still letting Creepy Joe drive. And now they start saying, maybe we don't like the implications. But we're certainly not about to admit the real problem. Now, that, of course, leads me to the actual story from Politico, which says nearly 36 House Democrats on Monday called on the senile one, Biden, they didn't say it that way, though, to relinquish his sole authority to launch nuclear weapons in the latest appeal to reform. Yeah, that's the excuse, the command and control structure, so that no single person can initiate a nuclear war. And listen to these prevaricators, quote, "Vesting one person with this authority entails real risks." Yeah, especially if he's a dementia patient, states the letter spearheaded by Representative Jimmy Panetta of California. Past presidents, they say, new present company accepted, have threatened to attack other countries with nuclear weapons or exhibited behavior that caused other officials to express concern about the president's judgment. Or maybe his mental capacity or even his sanity. Although they're not talking much about the 25th Amendment anymore now, are they? Now, forgetting for a minute that these idiots want to turn the decision over to a committee, Robert Heinlein once said, that's a life form with three or more heads and no brain. But still, can you just hear the phone call now at 3 a.m? Mr. Committee Member, we need to get your input on whether or not we should launch, because a whole bunch of nuclear missiles are headed this way. They'll be landing in, 3.5 minutes now, since it took a while to get the phone tree all online. Which takes me back again to that joke. Yeah, he's too drunk to sit in the back of the pickup truck, so let's let him drive. And a committee is obviously not the right answer either. Might take too long. I know! Have you seen The Terminator? Yeah, let's turn it all over to Skynet and let the artificially intelligent Terminator robots decide when to launch. What could possibly go wrong? And finally, just to send one more last shiver up your spine, there's an easy way for these leftists to accomplish exactly what they want. All they have to do is just slip the paperwork authorizing the change onto the desk of the senile marionette in chief. Because after all, everybody knows by now, he'll sign anything. From there, let's back up now and go to the early part of the week, where there were some more truths that were being revealed, but of course not by the U.S. waste stream media. There was, though, a bit of a surprise from major media down under. Late last week, Australian mainstream reporter Corey Bernardi became the first such to actually report on Joe Biden's obvious dementia. Who knows, maybe he feels like he's more free to do that now that there's an open war between Australia and Two Facebook. What he said wasn't even remotely a surprise to anybody that's been paying attention, but the shocking thing was to hear a mainstream reporter come out and admit the truth. Here's a bit of it anyway, courtesy of Sky News, the Populist Press, and the Gateway Pundit.
Never before has the leader of the free world been so cognitively compromised. It's clear, to me at the least, that US President Joe Biden is struggling with dementia and is clearly not up to the task he's been sworn in to do. This was apparent to many during the election campaign, but such was the hatred for Donald Trump by the partisan and poisonous mainstream media. They chose not to highlight anything that actually may have derailed a Biden victory. Even now, after he's been sworn in, many of them are still refusing to speak the truth about Biden's lack of capacity.
He goes on, of course, to play videotape clips and cite example after example, at least some of which listeners here have heard. We don't have time, of course, to do all of them. He then goes on to cite the obvious media bias and the cover-up surrounding other Biden scandals, from the Ukraine to the Hunter Biden laptop and corruption that exposed, but which wasn't reported, to...
They haven't asked Creepy Joe about the weird hair sniffing, the allegations of sexual misconduct, his previous support for segregation, the rather odd way that he interacts with women, and his overtly racist statements.
Which is all true, and certainly not on the waste stream radar. But you do have to love this big finish, where he nails the American media the way the honest press here used to talk about Pravda in the Soviet Union.
And reporting on the dumpster fire that was the Biden town hall, many media outlets simply omitted the gaffes, the lies, and the clear Chinese propaganda lines. It's like they're running a Biden protection racket, while simultaneously protecting themselves from admitting their unconscionable conduct during the election campaign.
And that includes the biggest election fraud in human history, and of course the subsequent cover-up, which continues,
was instrumental in having this man elected as president. It's all rather pathetic. But even usually smart people are blinded by the nonsense put out by the mainstream media. They believe every perceived sin of Donald Trump, while they seem intent on canonizing St. Joe.
I'd like to think the dam is starting to break when it comes to the truth finally coming out, but of course, we know better. Here's a certainly not-so-good news story that we all knew not to hold our breaths for anyway. The Supreme Court, the 9 black-robed priests of another god, proving that they're still for sale to the most communist bidder, or at least almost as blackmailable as John Roberts, has refused to review any of the cases surrounding the election fraud, first in Pennsylvania 2020. The court made the announcement on Monday morning, and all of the whores were on board, with the notable exception of Justices Alito, Gorsuch, and of course Clarence Thomas, who dissented. At this point, did you actually think Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett were going to do anything different? And the reason for dismissal is telling, and even refreshingly honest. The motions of Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated for leave to intervene as petitioner are dismissed as moot. Oh yeah, they stole it fair and square, covered it up, strong-armed us, and got away with it. So what are you complaining about now? Here's the capsule synopsis, folks. Before the election, no standing. After the election, hey, it's moot. And no, these weren't the droids you were looking for anyway. Attorney Sidney Powell, responding to the latest Supreme Court lawlessness, linked to Justice Thomas's dissent at Technofog, which said, among other things, the following, quote, "That is not a prescription for confidence. Changing the rules in the middle of the game is bad enough. Such rule changes by officials who may lack authority to do so is even worse. When those changes alter election results, said Justice Thomas, they can severely damage the electoral system on which our self-governance so heavily depends. If state officials have the authority they've claimed, we need to make it clear. If not, we need to put an end to this practice now, before the consequences become catastrophic." Unquote. Arguably, folks, he's right, but what the court said is, the hell with you, America, and your mangy little constitution, too. It's already too late. If there really is any hope for self-government, short of people withdrawing consent and saying, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, which is, of course, the answer of both American history and the Bible, it may come from those few state houses where representatives still think their oath matters for something. And New Hampshire may end up being one of those. The background of the story involves the electronic voting machine fraud that we're used to hearing about here, and absolutely not hearing about from the waste stream, much less the Supreme Court. As the Gateway Pundit has previously reported, a hand recount in the Rockingham District 7 New Hampshire House race in Windham, New Hampshire, found that the Dominion-owned voting machines there shorted every single Republican by roughly 300 votes, or about 6% of the total. That's a small enough number. Maybe they thought they could get away with it. Dr. David Strang, M.D., Belknap County State Republican Committee member, told TGP that the Republican candidates each had about 6% of their total votes removed by the Dominion-owned voting machines, which are, by the way, used in about 85% of the towns in New Hampshire. But what makes the manipulated results even more suspect are the following. Republicans flipped the New Hampshire Senate from 14-10 Democrat to 14-10 Republican in 2020. Likewise, in the landslide, they flipped the New Hampshire House as well, from a 230-156 majority of Democrats to 213-187 in favor of Republicans, and yet, the senile one, Joe Biden, who was fourth in the Democrat primary, and Kamala Harris, who didn't even make it to the primary, won the state, allegedly by almost 53% to 45% for Mr. Trump. And guess what that means without the 6% fraud? And it looks like the New Hampshire legislature is listening. And since the Supreme Court has already demonstrated they're pretty much worse than worthless, all of this kind of makes you wonder, what if a whole bunch of states admitted there was fraud? No, I know it's not going to happen in Maricopa County, Arizona, or Detroit, or Philadelphia. And come to think of it, Texas and a bunch of other states have already recognized that it happened in those places. But what if a whole bunch of other states came out with the truth, conducting audits like New Hampshire if necessary, or just indicting corrupt officials in places where the audit trail has already been destroyed, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, you know the names, certainly come to mind, and did what the Dakotas are already talking about as well, simply stating the obvious. Joe Biden is not anybody's president, much less this state's president. And we won't tolerate the executive orders or the tyrannical overreach of federal agents coming into this state and trying to, I think Jefferson put it this way, harass our people and eat out their substance, much less steal their firearms and destroy their businesses and livelihoods. But you know what, folks? I can't help but suggest they'd better make sure their power grid is in good shape before they try to talk about secession like Texas did. And for that matter, wherever you are, if your life ultimately depends in some way on the power grid, I'd suggest you better start thinking hard now about what you're going to do when, probably not if, it ultimately fails. Which brings me now to one of the most important things we need to talk about, and that's a post-mortem on the power grid failure in Texas. And elsewhere, of course, but they're getting the lion's share of the press. Still, AccuWeather estimates that total economic damage and loss due to this latest storm could amount to $45 to $50 billion. And this comes even though the U.S. economy is already on life support for a whole bunch of reasons that have been building for a long, long time, especially fiscal and monetary injections of newly printed money. But for some perspective, AccuWeather estimates that the 2020 hurricane season, one of the most active on record, only cost between $60 to $65 billion. So here's one storm, even if you might call it a two-parter, that did two-thirds or more of that. Over the weekend, an excellent bit of analysis came out courtesy of aggregator Zero Hedge and Cascand Strategy, which summarizes their findings by saying, in case there was any doubt why the Texas grid collapsed, the data is clear. First and foremost, wind failed because, quote, ice storms knocked out nearly half the wind power generating capacity of Texas on Sunday as a massive deep freeze across the state locked up wind turbine generators, creating an electricity generating crisis. Natural gas, though, was able to make up the difference for a while, but eventually everything else followed down. Some more detail lays out the events in sequence. The massive coal snap drove demand for electricity, especially given the number of heat pumps that are being mandated in some localities, well beyond normal levels. Wind power then failed to deliver its expected power, almost 40% of what it was billed for, in part due to the lack of winterized wind turbines, but then suffered from a lack of supply from non-winterized delivery. We'll have more on that in just a second. Coal and nuclear both underperformed, but not by much, due to non-winterized equipment. And as other sources have pointed out, they were also prohibited by federal regulators from helping to make up the difference, too. And we'll come back to that in a minute as well. And Texas's grid simply couldn't buy enough power from neighbors to make up the difference. Others, notes Tyler Durden, have summarized the Texas disaster this way. It's sad and ironic that in a state known for its huge petroleum and natural gas resources, the lack of reliability of wind power, and politically correct wind power at that, folks, has brought the state to its knees in a time of crisis. Not unlike what happened in politically correct California in 2020, during record heat where wind and solar couldn't meet the demand either, and the grid was therefore near collapse. The folly, summarizes Zero Hedge's piece, of chasing renewable energy as a means of mitigating so-called climate change, and we've now seen another example of the fact that they've been lying about the man-caused warming part of that, too, is making itself abundantly clear in Texas. When, they ask, oh, when, and your host will suggest, come on, are we kidding? Well, they wake up and realize that renewable energy almost always equates to unreliable energy. Or worse, folks, it's reliably unreliable when you need it the most. But as the truth continued to ooze out, it got even worse. Courtesy of Natural News and Ethan Huff, yep, we now know the Texas blackouts were deliberate. And had Beijing Biden simply signed off on Texas's initial request to up its energy generation maximum from the 60% that was all Big Brother was then allowing them to full capacity in anticipation of the recent polar vortex disaster, the Lone Star State never would have suffered any blackouts in spite of the windmill debacle, says a news aggregation site entitled Deplatformed. While many of the Texas green wind turbines failed when they froze, the state could have made up for this by pumping out the fossil fuels, currently prohibited under politically correct and asinine federal regulations, save for an exemption. And Texas Governor Greg Abbott evidently requested such of the Biden regime, only to be rejected despite the impending emergency, almost like they wanted them to die. So consequently, millions of Texans suffered through days of no power in record low temperatures, which injured many and killed at least 30. Quote, once it was clear that the polar vortex would engulf the entire state, Governor Abbott declared an emergency and asked the senile imposter in the White House for an EPA waiver to allow power generation facilities to operate at full capacity until the emergency passed. But Biden's so-called DOE refused Abbott's request and instead offered to allow only certain power generation facilities a waiver if they raised the prices they charged to Texans to more than $1,500 per megawatt hour. That's a dollar and a half a kilowatt hour, folks, which resulted in massive statewide power outages and a spectacular but not quite terminal failure of the grid. I guess we need to go to break with a question, given that it may have been part of the problem anyway. Wouldn't this have been a good time for Texas to have said, the hell with you, we're going to secede? And we'll be right back. Singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Welcome back now, folks, to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's pick it up here. Because given all of the nasty things that have been going on lately that turn out not to be coincidences, like the massive power outage in Texas, and of course other states as well, but we've now seen that the grid failures there go far beyond mere incompetence, even when that includes the federal government, we've got the continuing idiotic mask mandates that if you rip off the mask are clearly about nothing more than rubbing people's faces in it, literally. We've got businesses being destroyed en masse, still. We've got pipelines being shut down in the midst of a depression, and people's jobs being destroyed there en masse as well. And at the same time, we've got reopened borders bringing in more people. Hey, and they don't have to be screened for disease. Interesting. They don't have jobs, obviously, but Big Brother is promising them checks and a piece of your pie, whether you like it or not. They're stealing people's future, and they want to steal their guns. The reason why and the connection is obvious. They stole an election, too, and the Supreme Court later said, hey, good job. Worrying about it now is moot. Because the Chi-Comps already have their plant in the White House, and they're sticking their bioweapon into people's, well, whatevers. And that's getting covered up, too, along with all of the even short-term side effects. And you already know what they're going to do about the long-term side effects. So in the midst of example after example after example, and I didn't even go through the whole list, of the planned destruction of America, I'm going to start with a story today that, at the very least, ought to raise a whole bunch of eyebrows. And if you're half as cynical as your host, for good reason, you're already expecting a story just like this anyway. So let's go to a leftist source and see how they lay it out. From the Daily Mail in the UK, the entire Federal Reserve payment system crashes yesterday due to what they call operational error. Ooh, so sorry about that. Freezing 3 trillion fiat bucks in daily transactions, including paychecks, tax refunds, and bill payments. Yes, it says all Federal Reserve settlement services suffered disruptions on Wednesday. Key banking systems were offline for more than 3 hours. Not to worry your pretty little heads about it. The Fed says the massive outage was caused by, a little fat finger, they say operational error, and systems affected form the backbone of the U.S. banking and financial sectors. The Fed wire, they note, is used by banks to transfer an average of 3.3 trillion fiat bucks each and every day, while FedAch, does that rhyme with headache? That's Fed, capital A-C-H, handles smaller transactions such as paychecks and tax refunds. In the case of both of those, obviously much smaller. Potential impact, says the story, on consumer banking services were not immediately clear. In an alert, the Fed said the Federal Reserve banks have taken steps to help ensure the resilience of the Fedwire and NSS applications, including recovery to the point of failure. And by 3 p.m. Eastern, all of the affected services were back online, so don't worry your pretty little heads about it. As for your, yes, very cynical host, folks, I can't help but think, isn't it amazing we're seeing the failure, even temporarily, of so many massive critical infrastructure computer systems, from the election to power grids to now the banking system.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for. Move along. Move along.
And you know darn well you're already a conspiracy theorist, especially if you can connect even easy dots. So I can't help but think just two words, beta test. Not sure why. All right, for this next story, because you can't see the pictures, we're going to have to do a visual outline before I begin. Picture a pup tent, folks, but not the kind you can sleep in, a vertical kind that you can only stand up in. And they're lime green, by the way. Next, picture a bunch of kids with musical instruments being zipped inside of these things. Now, are we ready? On to today's, I bet you really can't believe this, COVIDiocy report. And I really did check, folks. There are multiple witnesses to this one online. Like, say, first, courtesy of ClassicFM.com and Wenatchee High School in the state of Washington. which they claim has found an inventive and admittedly hilarious, no, I would say it's downright sadistic, folks, way for its students to make music in the era of plandemic dumbing down. Back to the quote, since returning to in-person learning, sick, the Wenatchee High School has provided its musically inclined students with individual pop-up tents for band rehearsals. Each student is zipped into their own pop-up tent along with their instrument. There's a really sad shot, folks, of a guy hunched inside one of these torture chambers with a tuba. Still, though, it says the tent rap musicians must play their music solo while socialist distancing, 6 feet apart, and the band also rehearses in shifts to reduce any actual social contact, and they claim, kind of idiotically, the chance of spreading the booga booga flu. I gotta admit, folks, I see this child abuse, it just makes me angry. Paul Joseph Watson comes closer to the truth. The images, his story says, shows the school band socialist distancing inside human tents, meaning it's clown world that strikes again. The picture, he begins, appears to show two girls playing saxophones while trapped inside the awning-like structures, while others in the background try to play flute. In the background, it looks like you can see some poor girl hunched over trying to play a violin inside this idiotic thing. Wonder what that'll do to her form, not to mention her spinal column and her shoulder. And the article quotes Wenatchee principal Eric Anderson, who celebrates the fact that the school environment has been carefully tailored to ensure that students are never allowed to remove their face coverings. Quote, there's never any reason in this building, said the Marquis de Sade wannabe, where a kid has to take their mask off. Come on, you blithering idiot. Even babies in diapers occasionally get a time out. Comments Paul Joseph Watson, growing up in a world where they've now been forcibly isolated from one another, starved of physical contact, and cannot properly even discern facial reactions while having to wear these humiliating human tents, it does make you want to ask, what could possibly go wrong? Answer, folks, it already has. It's just that when it comes to effects, you still ain't seen nothing yet. From there, I guess it's only logical, and if I'd ever been on to Facebook, I'm sure that would be enough to get me banned. Anyway, it's only logical that we go to this piece from the Mises Institute and Anthony Rosmaggi, who writes, a year later, there's still no evidence showing governments can control the spread of booga booga booga, the COVID-1984 pandemic, with their so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, or NPIs, things like idiotic mask mandates, curfews, capacity restrictions, gathering restrictions, and basically anything else they can think of to destroy what was once called human society and a functioning economy. As we approach, he says, the one-year anniversary of the 15 days, ha 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 ha, yeah, sure, to flatten the curve, we've yet to acquire any data suggesting that the past year of life-destroying lockdowns and politicized behavioral mandates has done anything whatsoever to keep us safe from COVID-19. Let's not forget, though, it did bring us a successful communist overthrow. And while discussions surrounding the reintroduction of national lockdown seems to have ceased, now that the communist tool is in the White House, it's impossible to ignore the lockdown's disproportionately deadly effects and numerous studies that have demonstrated their futility. While the media still clings to their grip on the narrative that these NPIs have done anything to help the fight against COVID-19, government officials in lockstep with big tech and nearly all major leftist news outlets, but maybe I repeat myself, have controlled the NPI narrative to such an extent that its proponents have simply sidestepped the entire issue of burden of proof that would naturally arise from the introduction and continued support of novel virus mitigation strategies. And instead, they happily point to the fact that their ideas enjoy unanimous support from anybody who's still allowed to talk, i.e. corporate media and government officials all over the world. The seemingly impenetrable narrative rests, of course, on one critical assumption, and your host will say it this way, folks, it is unmitigated bullshit that NPIs or behavioral mandates have protected us from COVID-19. And here he points to the one chart that the COVID doomsayers can't explain, noting all you have to do to highlight the ineffectiveness of nearly a year's worth of NPIs would be to look at a chart comparing hospitalizations and deaths per millions in Florida versus either California or New York. Maybe New York isn't such a good example, because Andrew Cuomo deliberately killed a whole bunch of people there, becoming one of the biggest mass murderers in that state's history, when he confined a bunch of actually virulent Wu flu cases to the most vulnerable populations in nursing homes, and true to form, a lot of them did die, at least with COVID, along with the other comorbidities that were already there, but it did help to reduce the surplus population. But still, any look at the data, especially in graphical form, for those that haven't been dumbed down to the point where they can't read a graph, suggests that, quote, in light of everything our officials have taught us about how this virus spreads, it defies reality that Florida, a fully open and popular travel destination with one of the most elderly populations in the country, currently has lower hospitalizations and deaths per million than California, a state with much heavier restrictions, downright totalitarian even, and one of the youngest populations in the country to boot. Florida, he notes, has zero restrictions on bars, breweries, indoor dining, gyms, places of worship, gathering sizes, and almost all schools are offering in-person instruction. Whereas the People's Republic of California, on the other hand, retains totalitarian restrictions in each of these areas. And at the very least, Florida's hospitalizations and death per million should be substantially worse, if we believe the hype, than California's. All those who predicted death and destruction as a consequence of Florida's September reopening simply can't see these results as anything other than utterly remarkable. Well, how about utterly unremarkable, folks, because the Waystream Press, knowing that they speak for themselves, simply would prefer not to talk about them. Even the White House COVID advisor, Andy Slavitt, much to the establishment's embarrassment, had no explanation for Florida's success relative to California. Slavitt was reduced to just parroting establishment talking points after admitting that Florida's surprisingly great numbers were, quote, just a little beyond our explanation, unquote. The author then goes on correctly to look at a bunch of elements that may explain the variance here, as any good researcher would ordinarily do, but the media only seems to want to do if it tends to debunk their bogus narrative. Anyway, those variables would include things like compliance with the unconstitutional mandates via masks, bar visits, travel, restaurant visits, and the like. In other words, and you've surely heard this, is it possible that these totalitarian lockdown measures aren't working because the slaves aren't complying in high enough numbers and saying, "Yes, master, may I have another?" Turns out the answer is nope, that ain't it either. Matter of fact, Californians are, for the most part, behaving like good little slaves. Even the state's socialist distancing scores, which again indicate that Californians have been doing a better job avoiding activities that, Big Brother tells them, facilitate the spread of the booga booga flu. Even Gulag's COVID mobility reports as of mid-February this year show that Californians partake in fewer retail and recreational visits. They get less vitamin D in the sunshine, too, it would seem. And evidently, he says, the whole non-compliant shtick is nothing more than a fraudulent excuse for explaining away undesirable data and trends. In fact, he says, if we visualize case trends, and remember, folks, PCR false positive test cases are not equal to somebody actually having the China flu, and yeah, Beijing Biden can take that one and stuff it. But even the case trends show each state has varying levels of restrictions, and you'll quickly notice a pattern, says the author, that presents itself quite similarly across all 50 states. A bump in cases early to midway through the year, followed by a much bigger surge in cases during the winter months. The following data, he notes, was retrieved from Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Research Center, and it shows similar patterns across 50 states, demonstrating what's well known as seasonality. You see it every year with flu cases. And yeah, you may be seeing it again this year, too, with flu cases. But isn't it interesting? They're not calling them flu cases. They got a better explanation. Still, though, the pattern is there, whether Big Brother and his big media partner like it and want to talk about it or not. And for a firm believer, he says, in NPIs, these simultaneous and nearly identical fluctuations between cities within the same state and states that have similar climates are kind of inexplicable. Yeah, right, if you say so. Because, again, it doesn't show that the NPIs have anything to do with what else is going on. And here I have to pause and say, hey, it's kind of like the science of non-existent man-made global warming and the science of green energy that doesn't actually pay for itself over its lifetime. It boils down to, don't confuse me with the facts, or the science, or the data, or actual experimental evidence, anything of the sort, because I've already made up my mind. And I'm even using my government-funded research to pay to give me that correct answer. You can make a similar case, and he does, for what he refers to as the media who cried super spreader. Remember the hospital surges that were supposed to have ravaged them following Thanksgiving and Christmas and all the super spreader events then at holiday gatherings nationwide? Didn't happen. And there's more, like Alabama, where thousands of maskless football fans took to the streets to celebrate their team winning the National College Football title. And yet, even after that highly publicized super spreader event, cases continued to plummet. And if that wasn't enough, Mississippi, Alabama's next door neighbor, followed with a nearly identical case pattern despite hosting no alleged super spreader events. And cases are still dropping. No, the author here doesn't talk about it, folks. Your host has mentioned it, as have others. It just could be that since the CDC decided, hey, now that China's man, and our man too, is inserted into the White House, we can back off on those CT numbers, and the cases will drop, because the real cases never got up to the point where the false positives said they were anyway. And let's not forget for a minute, folks, there's still part B of a bioweapon to consider. And you can rest assured that if and when that second shoe drops, none of the recommended governmental interventions, pharmaceutical or non, are going to make a darn bit of difference. Conclusion? The data seems to have spoken, and it's now abundantly clear, for those that have eyes to see anyway, your host interjects, that attempting to socially engineer a respiratory virus out of existence is nothing short of a fool's errand. Well, folks, there's another explanation as well. It was never about the respiratory virus. It was about destroying an entire society. And on that score, you got to admit, socialist distancing and all of Big Brother's pre-planned and mandated interventions have been massively, I would say even satanically, successful. And there's certainly more proof out on that score today as well. Joe Biden's pick for Attorney General. Evidently, he figured out Janet Reno really was dead. Still, though, another deep state totalitarian to the core, Merrick Garland, was in Swamp Central earlier this week telling the swamp critters why he was just the guy to run the new American Gestapo. Now, remember, these are the very people, and that includes this guy, who pretty much want to hang anybody that objected to the election fraud and subsequent coup, especially if they came to Washington, D.C. and thought they had a right to protest or even petition the government for a redress of their grievances. But when it comes to the actual law of the land, well, they'll talk about the Constitution, but not about the parts that they don't like that Second Amendment thing, or the right to freedom of assembly, speech, or worship, or to be free in your own person's houses, papers, and effects from anything they darn well want to do to you. From muzzling you, to strapping you down and forcing you to take some experimental DNA-altering gene therapy. And it's certainly edifying to see how he rationalizes that some animals really are more equal than others, especially when it comes to rioting and looting. When questioned by Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, and he's one of the ones they want to get rid of course, about whether or not he considers Antifa and Black Lives Matter attacks on places like the courthouse in Portland, and whether those are domestic terrorism, the senile puppet's pick for Attorney General, Merrick Garland, said he might not, because those happened at night. I don't blame you. I'd want to hear that for myself, too.
Let me ask you about assaults on federal property in places other than Washington, D.C., Portland, for instance, Seattle. Do you regard assaults on federal courthouses or other federal property as acts of domestic extremism, domestic terrorism?
Well, Senator, my own definition, which is about the same as the statutory definition, is the use of violence or threats of violence, an attempt to disrupt democratic processes. So an attack on a courthouse while in operation, trying to prevent judges from actually deciding cases, that plainly is domestic extremism, domestic terrorism. An attack simply on a government property at night or any other kind of circumstances is a clear crime and a serious one and should be punished. I don't know enough about the facts of the example you're talking about, but that's where I draw the line. One is both are criminal. But one is a core attack on our democratic institutions.
Of course, if they were wearing MAGA hats and objecting to the policies of our communist Chinese masters, well, any time of day, that would be domestic terrorism. Good grief. Matt Walsh pointed out that one could argue, if one had half a brain, that attempting to burn down a federal building at night just might be an attempt to interrupt its normal functioning the next day. But then in this man's America, one might find themselves accused of wrongthink or even whiteness. And as for domestic terrorism, well, that means whatever they decide it means, depending obviously on who it is that they want to charge with it. Given that this guy almost makes the Janet Reno look good by comparison, I wish somebody had asked him, hey, how about an attack on a church in broad daylight? Does that constitute domestic terrorism? How about if you gas them first and then burn them alive, Merrick? If this wasn't all so deadly serious, folks, it'd literally be a sick joke. But the man who would be head of Biden's Inquisition wasn't done. Because when it comes to things that aren't crimes, it really does seem like selective enforcement is a key tenet of his principled stance.
Just a fundamental question. Do you believe that illegal entry at America's border should remain a crime?
Well, I haven't thought about that question. I just haven't thought about that question.
What? He'd already been asked about it several times in this hearing alone. And this guy comes to the Senate thinking he might be Attorney General and hasn't thought about illegal immigration?
Come on, man.
Well, I haven't thought about that question. I just haven't thought about that question. I think, you know, the president has made clear that we are a country of with the borders and with a concern about national security. I don't know of a proposal to decriminalize but still make it unlawful to enter. I just don't know the answer to that question. I haven't thought about it.
Will you continue to prosecute unlawful border crossings?
Well, this is, again, a question of allocation of resources. We will, the department will prevent unlawful crossing. I don't know. I have to admit, I just don't know exactly what the conditions are and how this is done. I think if I don't know what the current program even is with respect to this. If there, I assume that the answer would be yes, but I don't know what.
So is he an idiot or a bald-faced liar? I'll admit it's tempting to go with all of the above. One thing's for sure, though, he's a pick that deserves to rate right up there with Mr. Fast and Furious and the Butcher of Waco. And I look at the last decade or more, folks, when it comes to attorneys general, and really wish we could have just had Bozo the Clown instead. Asked by Delaware communist Chris Coons about whether he'd be interested in working with them on further restricting what's left of the Bill of Rights, especially that pesky First Amendment thing, Garland finally didn't need to hem and haw.
I'm extremely interested, if I'm confirmed, in working with the members of Congress, and particularly on bipartisan legislation. I don't know specifically about those, but each of them has the ring of something that's very important and quite reasonable.
Well, enactable, reasonable, moving the ball forward are the sorts of things I hope we get to work on.
After patting himself some on the back, he asked this.
One of the core things we'll be looking at is how online misinformation is contributing to domestic terrorism, to division here. You've discussed your own experience with domestic terrorism cases and your plan to prioritize this issue. It's something the FBI director has said is one of our most pressing threats.
Unless, of course, it's rioting, looting, arson, and knocking over federal buildings at night by communists, in which case it's just fine.
Do you think the DOJ has a role to play in examining the role of misinformation and incitement online to contributing to violence
Spit it out, man. Do you think the DOJ has a role in continuing to help us to deep six the Bill of Rights?
Well, again, Senator, I think that every opportunity the Justice Department has to work with members of the Senate to think about how to solve problems and how to craft legislation is one that we should take. I don't have in mind particular legislation in this area. I do think that an important part of the investigation of violent extremist groups is following their activities online and getting an idea of what kind of information and misinformation is being put out.
That's why we have warrantless searches and public-private partners like Gulag, Twitter, to Facebook.
Well, I look forward to talking more about this with you.
And let's not forget the January 6th scapegoats.
Last, I'm glad to see the department is prosecuting. I think there's 235 charges brought so far against rioters who invaded the Capitol and attacked our democracy on January 6th.
Unless, of course, they were working for us undercover and affiliated with BLM and Antifa, as has now been revealed, but not prosecuted. like the head of Utah's Antifa, who got his great big payday.
I've supported calls for a 9/11-style independent commission.
You mean like the one that covered up that false flag attack?
To investigate the bigger picture of what caused this and what we might learn from it.
Bottom line, would you support another massive whitewash like that? Well, of course he will. It was, after all, very useful in covering up that false flag.
So with those caveats, I certainly could not object to anything that the Congress would want to do in this regard.
Anything? Evidently. And I think that tells us a whole lot about what these people have planned.